For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sail, and coming up this week, we continue our review of this year's Silip Carnegie shortlist with the author of On Midnight Beach, Mary Louise Fitzpatrick. I venture back to Victorian England to investigate a sensational tale of murder and intrigue. And Lynn Truss takes us back to the 1950s for a seaside crime caper. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Marie-Louise Fitzpatrick is an award-winning author and illustrator. In the past, she's been nominated for the Silip Kate Greenaway Medal for her books for younger children. This year, however, she's been shortlisted for a Silip Carnegie Medal for On Midnight Beach, her first novel for young adults. The book breathes new magic into an ancient legend, as she told me when she joined me from her home in Ireland. Marie-Louise, welcome to Read On.
Thanks for having me.
For those who haven't yet picked up On Midnight Beach, can you lead us into the story?
It's 1976 and a dolphin swims into a small bay in Donegal and two rival fishing villages pretty much go to war over the dolphin because it starts attracting tourists and their money. And a young girl called Emer and her pals, they start creeping out of their bedroom windows at midnight to go swimming with the dolphin after the tourists have gone home. And Emer starts to fall for the local wild lad, whose name is Doug Cullen.
And the book actually begins with the legend, the story of how Doug got his name as a child.
Yes, and this is where you absolutely don't need to know the original legend, but I am actually retelling the legend of Cú Chulainn and a legend called the Tháinig Bó Cúinne in this. It's an ancient legend, thousands of years old. It's the big epic Irish legend, and the bulls in my retelling are dolphins, whereas in the original, they're actual bulls of the bovine variety. And there's a very famous story about how Cú Chulainn, which literally translates to Hound of Cullen, Dog Cullen, in the original gets his name. And I've rewritten that in my version. But it's more or less the same thing. When he's a child, he kills a dog with a hurley stick and a slither, the little ball that's used in hurling. Hurling is the Irish national game. Again, it's thousands of years old. And the killing of the dog to protect himself or somebody else is what gives Cú Chulainn his name and what gives my character Doug Cullen his name.
And it is a heroic act, and it separates him out from the other kids in the village. Everybody has a respect for him. It's not just his good looks that mean that people are rather in awe of him.
No, he can be a bit of a loner, and yet he's friends with everyone. He doesn't really follow the crowd. He's slightly other, and yet people admire him. Of course, the fact that he plays on the local hurling team makes him a hero automatically, and he's the best player. So he's admired by adults and his peers. But also, he's a bit of a poet. He's shy in one way and outgoing in another, which is very much based on the character in the original legend, who is supposed to be good at everything, you know, as they were in all the old legends. But he's also got a pretty violent streak. Once his temper is up and he's been challenged, he doesn't know how to stand down. And that, of course, causes trouble.
And in that respect, he's very much like Achilles. The legend of Cú Chulainn is Ireland's Iliad. And as Achilles' rage is his fatal flaw, for Doug Cullen, he loses all focus on anything else.
Yes, yeah. He just goes straight to red. He's dangerous. And that, I suppose, is, as a kid, I would have been told this legend in school, and we saw him as a hero. I suppose as an adult, that's what I was looking at, is why do we admire violence and the killing machine that, say, Achilles or dog Cú Chulainn? What makes us admire that in people? In the original legend, he literally kills hundreds. So I don't go there with this, but I'm looking at violence and I'm looking at what we think a hero is. And I suppose for me, the hero is Ymir.
Who becomes his girlfriend?
Yes. Yeah, she does. Yeah. She loves him, but she doesn't like this side of him. And she's torn about loving him completely when this is who he is. And obviously fearful of where it's going to lead.
And it's a coming of age story from her point of view. She's in her last year at school and she's working in her father's shop. And that shop also provides a view of the patriarchy that rules both Carrot Cove, where she and Dog live, and Ross, the slightly bigger town across the bay, which feels aggrieved at Carrot Cove's acquisition of a tourist industry around the Dolphin.
Yes, yes, particularly since it's the place with the big hotel and the fancy pub. So it's losing its summer trade to the fishing village that it looks down on very much because it is a fishing village. And there you have Maeve, who in the original legend is the big other protagonist. Queen Maeve is a famous character in Irish legend, but I've redrawn her as a 17-year-old girl whose dad, if you like, is the big businessman in Ross, and she's keeping an eye on what's happening to his businesses because of the Dolphin and decides to get involved and try to kidnap Rin the Dolphin in a rather crazy scheme. Maeve is out for herself, if you like, but she never lets on to be anything else. I suppose that's one of the reasons why Irish women love her. Is she's amoral, she's powerful, but ultimately she's exactly who she says she is, unlike the male characters who are all driven by a desire to have their name live forever in Ireland and to go down as heroes. Maeve doesn't give a toss about being heroic. She just wants what she wants in the moment. You know? She's honestly a bad girl, if you like. And that's what appeals to Irish women about her, I think. Mm. That she just reaches out and takes what she wants.
And as you say, she hatches this wonderful, bonkers plan to kidnap Rin, which forms a terrific action scene at the centre of the book. And standing at the middle of this pivot is the character of Gus, who is your second narrator, who has a foot in both camps and is finding it difficult to balance.
Yes, Gus doesn't quite see what everybody's rowing about either, but he comes originally from Carrig. His childhood was spent in Carrick Cove with his brother, and they move to Ross just before they become teenagers, and they never quite fit in because they don't belong there. And he wants to fit in on one level, but a bit like several of the characters, he's a lone wolf in his own way. And similarly, he just wants to get on with life and is just looking forward to getting out of Ross and probably going to Dublin or London at some point once he's left school. Getting away, basically, from small town living is where his eye is set. But he gets drawn into the conflict and he's torn throughout it because he gets drawn in by Maeve, who he starts a relationship with. He's definitely on one level kind of crazy about her, but on the other level knows that he's being used. And that's exactly the original story. Similarly, Fergus is being used. Fergus is the name of the character in the original. And he's the most human character in the original version. If you read the translation from the first written version, Fergus is, he just comes across as really real. Unlike all the characters that you normally meet in myth, he just comes across as this really real guy. You can really identify with him. It's like he just doesn't know what everybody's doing and why everybody's acting this way. And, you know, he's crazy about Cú Chulainn. He's got a huge fondness for him and can't bear the idea of letting him down. So he sometimes goes against Maeve and helps out in my version, Dog.
And all this is playing out against the background of the summer of 1976, which for all those of us who lived through it is seared in our memory as just being unseasonably hot.
Yes.
And likewise, it sets tempers a simmer in both the two villages.
Yes. I was 14 in 1976 and it was an amazing summer. I mean, when you look at the temperatures written down, they really don't get across how hot it actually was. I remember the reservoir for Dublin just sank until the village that had been drowned to make the reservoir, the spire of the church, appeared in the middle of the lake. I remember my sandals getting stuck in the tarmac where it was melting in places. And just having freckles the size of saucers, you know, it's just you couldn't get out of the sun. And for me, too, it was the first time I went to the Gaeltacht, which is Irish summer school, if you like. And that's a rite of passage for Irish kids. When we hit teenage years, we usually go at least once, spend a month over in the west of Ireland. We get packed onto trains with bicycles and haversacks and go and stay in the middle of nowhere. We're living in houses with families, but there might be 16 of us to a house. And you're talking about maybe 200 teenage boys and girls from different parts of Ireland plonked into the middle of nowhere with swimming in the sea and going to classes in the morning and disappearing on your bikes, oh, God knows where, and then dances in the evening. And it's for most of us, it's our first time away from home. So it was a huge summer for me because it was my first time doing that and first boyfriend, all that kind of stuff. And then you had this sunshine and this amazing summer, unforgettable summer. And also it was the year Thin Lizzy had The Boys Are Back in Town. That was the soundtrack.
And you recapture that beautifully. It's an incredibly evocative book. And the audio version has been brought wonderfully to life by Alana Kerr Collins. Did you have anything to do with the selection of Alana as a narrator?
Yes, there was someone else put forward and I wasn't as keen on her voice. And I liked Alana's voice when I heard it and thought it sounded like the best fit with Emer in particular. I very, very much obviously wanted a somewhat Irish voice because it's in first person. So I particularly liked her voice and was really pleased when they said she could do it.
For a moment, nobody moved. Then everyone came at once. The girls I'd been skipping with inched out onto the road. The boys came racing across from the green. They all formed a circle around the dog and the boy with the hurley stick. Mary's leg was covered in blood. She whimpered in protest as I hauled her to her feet, but I was determined to see what was happening. I put my arm around her and took her weight as we hobbled over to where Rashers had fallen. We pushed our way into the circle. "He's dead," someone said. "He's pretending," someone else said. "He'll jump up in a minute and savage the lot of us." But there was no doubt. Rashers was dead. Up till then, in my imagination, death looked like sleep. That day, I understood that death has its own particular stillness. Rasher's eyes were glazed. His teeth were frozen in a surprised snarl. There was blood in the white spittle foaming about his mouth. His paws were limp and heavy on the ground. He was dead, dead, dead. As dead as the half cows hanging in Butcher Hegarty's shop window. As dead as the pig's head with the wizened apple on the cracked china plate. As dead as the sheep's hearts on the metal tray, as the tripe and the rashers arranged in squelchy rows besides the heaps of dead pink sausages.
"You killed him,"
Gus McCroy said. His eyes were big as balloons.
Alana Kerr Collins, narrating on Midnight Beach, written by my guest, Mary-Louise Fitzpatrick. Now, one thing that blind readers will not be able to appreciate is the beautiful cover. Could you describe it for us, please?
Sure. The cover is both dramatic and romantic looking at the same time, which is a good feat to achieve. And it was quite difficult finding the cover for this book because it's both a romance and, of course, it's a very dramatic book at the same time. So it's quite difficult to get that across. So it looks like it's nighttime. And of course, on Midnight Beach, it had to look like it was nighttime. It's an overview of a beach. So it's like you are looking down on a beach and you're watching the sea come onto the sand. And there's this huge surf line that's going diagonally across the cover with the title On Midnight Beach on black on the white surf. And in the navy blue sea, there's a figure, a small figure of a girl floating. So she's just looking up at you like you're a seagull, if you like. You've got a seagull's eye view. And you can also see the reflection of the moon in the water. And you can see footsteps going into the surf. It is a huge relief to have a cover that you can really love as an author rather than one that you hate. And it doesn't work for the book at all. And so, you know, once we hit on this cover, it was like relief and delight. And then when the book came out, just everybody reacted to the cover. You know, it was immediately people said, oh my God, I love the cover. So
you built your reputation as an author and illustrator for younger children. Mm-hmm. Was this a story that was bubbling away in the back of your head and needed to be told?
When I was in college, I had this idea. I was starting to realize that children's books was where I was headed. I did art in college, I did design, and I was doing illustration, and I thought I would love to do a picture book of the Thorn, the original legend. And I always thought I'd do that, but then, you know, about 10 years later, I realized the Thorn didn't lend itself remotely to a picture book. It's just all wrong for a picture book for young kids. I gave up on the idea and just let it go, I thought, until about, I'd say, maybe 8 or 9 years ago. I had started writing novels at that point. I had a few under my belt. And somebody said to me, if you have old ideas that you gave up on, have you ever thought of going sideways with them? That night when I was about to drop off, literally, I had to wake myself up, turn on the light, grab a pen and paper. Because suddenly I got the idea of not a picture book for the Thorn, a YA novel, make them all teenagers, 17, 18 years of age, get rid of all the cast of thousands, bring it down to just the main characters, set it in two fishing villages, and instead of bulls, you've got bull dolphins. Mm-hmm. And once I got, it was like literally, I had the ending right down to the bit I won't mention. The surprise bit at the end, which is my ending to the story, I got it right there and then. So yes, it was always there, but 2 decades before I figured out how to do it.
And do you think you will stay with young adult fiction, or are you already writing another book for younger readers?
I am writing at the moment middle grade. I have 2 YA stories there. When I say there, they're literally sitting in the corner behind me at different stages. But I think because of COVID last year and this year, dark YA stories just didn't seem like a very good place to be in my head. I got an idea this time waking up in the morning for a kind of a fun adventure middle grade story. And that's where I've gone. And I've been working on picture books as well.
Well, On Midnight Beach is a fantastic novel, both for young people and adults. I certainly felt very happy to be transported back to 1976. You must be delighted that that has struck a chord with the Philip Carnegie Medal judges.
Oh, it's a huge, huge thrill to find myself on the shortlist. It's like a dream come true just to have the Carnegie shortlisted author tag attached to my name is absolutely amazing.
Well, thank you so much for taking us further into the world of On Midnight Beach and for being a guest on the show.
Thanks for having me.
On Midnight Beach by Marie-Louise Fitzpatrick is available in print, ebook, and audio wherever you buy your books. And Marie-Louise will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Lynn Truss puts Constable Twitten on the case of correct pronunciation. But first, one of the great joys of reading is swapping recommendations with others. When I've finished a great book, I can't wait to spread the word and find out what others are enjoying, which is why I always welcome your Educating Read suggestions. A couple of years ago, when Sam Hepburn came to the RNIB Talking Book Studios to discuss her psychological thriller, Her Perfect Life, she had no hesitation in recommending Lady Audley's Secret by Mary Elizabeth Braddon. Like so many other Victorian classics, I knew the title but had never read the book. At university, it was just one of dozens of weighty tomes on an impossible reading list. Thereafter, I never got round to filling the gaps in my education. Until now. The novel was published in 1862, but like many other Victorian classics, it appeared first serialised in a weekly magazine. So there are plenty of cliffhangers in a plot that caused quite a stir. In fact, Lady Audley's Secret has been described as the most sensationally successful of all sensation novels.
Choose between the two alternatives, Mr. Audley. Shall you or I find my brother's murderer? He looked in her face and saw that her resolution was the fruit of no transient womanish enthusiasm which would give way under the iron hand of difficulty. Her beautiful features, naturally statuesque in their noble outlines, seemed transformed into marble by the rigidity of her expression. The face in which he looked was the face of a woman whom death only could turn from her purpose. "I have grown up in an atmosphere of suppression," she said quietly. "I have stifled and dwarfed the natural feelings of my heart until they have become unnatural in their intensity. I have been allowed neither friends nor lovers. My mother died when I was very young. My father has always been to me what you saw him today. I have had no one but my brother. All the love that my heart can hold has been centred upon him. Do you wonder, then, that when I hear that his young life has been ended by the hand of treachery, that I wish to see vengeance done upon the traitor?" "Oh, my God!" she cried suddenly, clasping her hands and looking up at the cold winter sky. "Lead me to the murderer of my brother, and let mine be the hand to avenge his untimely death." Robert Audley stood looking at her with awe-stricken admiration. Her beauty was elevated into sublimity by the intensity of her suppressed passion. She was different to all other women that he had ever seen. His cousin was pretty. His uncle's wife was lovely. But Clara Tallboys was beautiful. Niobe's face, sublimated by sorrow, could scarcely have been more purely classical than hers. Even her dress, Puritan in its grey simplicity, became her beauty better than a more beautiful dress would have become a less beautiful woman. "Miss Tallboys," said Robert after a pause, "your brother shall not be unavenged. He shall not be forgotten. I do not think that any professional aid which you could procure would lead you as surely to the secret of this mystery as I can lead you, if you are patient and trust me."
"I will trust you," she answered, "for I see that you will help me."
"I believe that it is my destiny to do so," he said solemnly.
The plot revolves around Audley Court, a country house estate in Essex, where the elderly baronet, Sir Michael Audley, has just married a much younger and very beautiful governess, Lucy Graham. Very little is known of the new Lady Audley's past. But when Sir Michael's nephew Robert arrives with his friend George Tallboys, Lucy begins to behave oddly, trying very hard to avoid them. George has recently returned from Australia, where he's made his fortune, only to discover that in his absence, his wife has died. He's distraught, and Robert brings him to Audley Court for a break. But once there, George too begins to act strangely. And then he disappears without a word. Suspecting foul play and convinced that Lady Audley is hiding something, Robert sets out to investigate.
The plot owes much to the real-life Road Hill House murder of 1860. It too involved the marriage between a governess and a much older, richer man. Its lurid details fascinated and appalled the Victorian public, and inspired a slew of other Victorian sensation novels, such as The Woman in White and The Moonstone. The Road Hill case was brilliantly re-examined by Kate Summerscale in The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher. Indeed, the painstaking methods employed by Robert Audley as he crisscrosses the country interviewing witnesses and gathering evidence against his suspect mirror those employed by Mr. Witcher. It's a fast-moving investigation that makes full use of the newly built railway network. But while on one level it's an early example of detective fiction, the book's themes run deeper than that. It reflects contemporary anxieties about the effects of the Industrial Revolution. Rapid urbanisation and the spread of the railways brought huge social change. People had never been so mobile or so anonymous. The book plays on fears about stranger danger. Its opening paragraph paints a perfect picture of Audley Court before an outsider came to live in its midst.
It lay low down in a hollow, rich with fine old timber and luxuriant pastures, and you came upon it through an avenue of limes, bordered on either side by meadows, over the high hedges of which the cattle looked inquisitively at you as you passed, wondering perhaps what you wanted, for there was no thoroughfare, and unless you were going to the court, you had no business there at all.
The outside world brings change and misfortune with it. But the book also questions the wisdom of a society that sets such store by ancestry and appearance, and that seeks to put women on pedestals.
Good heavens, exclaimed Robert, as he watched the merry party of equestrians until they disappeared under the archway. What does all this mean? How charmingly she sits her horse. What a pretty figure, too, and fine, candid, brown, rosy face. But to fly at a fellow like that without the least provocation, that's the consequence of letting a girl follow the hounds. She learns to look at everything in life as she does at 6 feet of timber or sunk fence. She goes through the world as she goes across country, straight ahead and over everything. Such a nice girl as she might have been, too, if she'd been brought up in Fig Tree Court. If I ever marry and have daughters, which remote contingency may heaven forfend, they shall be educated in paper buildings, take their sole exercise in the temple gardens, and they shall never go beyond the gates till they are marriageable, when I will take them straight across Fleet Street to St. Dunstan's Church and deliver them into the hands of their husbands.
By exploring the motivations and psychology of her characters and the society that they live in, Braddon gives extra punch to the questions that she raises about sanity and imprisonment. At times I forgot that I was reading a novel written over 150 years ago. The prose rattles along at a great pace. The dialogue is spot on, and the characters have the full range of faults and foibles that you'd expect to find in one of today's historical page-turners. This impression was only enhanced by Jenny Coversack's brilliant narration on the talking book version that I downloaded from Overdrive. Using a full palette of voices, she brought the characters vividly to life. In case you haven't guessed the ending, I loved this book. Perhaps I should have read it for my English degree, but it just goes to prove that it's never too late to catch up on your education. My thanks to Sam Hepburn for a brilliant recommendation. Lady Audley's Secret is available in various formats from the RNIB library, including as TB20551.
The RNIB is committed to providing life-changing support and specialist services. Services that we know people affected by sight loss need now more than ever. But we need your help. The coronavirus outbreak represents an unprecedented situation for all of us. For RNIB, it's having a huge impact on our ability to raise the money we need to continue vital services at a time when so many of us are feeling isolated and anxious. The need for access to information and to feel socially connected is critical for all of us. With an increase in demand, we're working hard to keep vital services running so that blind and partially sighted people don't have to face this crisis alone. But we need your help. This is a time for community and coming together, and we need your support now more than ever. Please help RNIB today to support the 2 million people in the UK with sight loss, their friends, family and carers. Donate at 0330 002 0893 or use the website rnib.org.uk/urgent appeal. Thank you.
This is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Mary Louise Fitzpatrick to hear the books of her life... Lynn Truss is a columnist, writer and broadcaster whose book on punctuation, Eats, Shoots and Leaves, was an international bestseller. She's now turned her hand to crime writing. The Man That Got Away is the second in her Constable Twitten series.
Whatever you want to know, wherever you want to go, inquire of a Brighton Bell. Incidentally, it had taken a small committee of men in suits around 2 hours to come up with that slogan. It was the grammar that worried them. Did you inquire of or inquire from? Opinion was divided equally, and there was an awkward impasse until the young clerk employed to take the minutes piped up unexpectedly that he couldn't listen to this any longer and that inquire from was technically illiterate. So at last, they had their answer. But the members of the committee were not embarrassed. They were pleased to have undertaken such a lengthy deliberation in the public interest. At this time in Brighton's iffy town planning history, when great swathes of venerable Regency architecture were being demolished on a say-so to oblige the interests of dodgy developers, it was important that other matters municipal should appear to be above board.
Set in 1950s Brighton, it's a joyous blend of Endeavour Morse and Ealing comedy. But as I discovered when she joined me in the studio, she's still on the case as far as the correct use of the English language is concerned. Lynn Truss, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much.
As I say in the introduction, this is the second of the Constable Twitten novels, and it's set in Brighton in the 1950s. What was the inspiration for Twitten?
Oh, do you know, it goes back such a long way, but I originally wrote a series for the radio called Inspector Steen, and the four characters in Inspector Steen are the main characters in the new novels with Twitten as the hero. I suppose, originally, I was very interested in the usual comic trope, I suppose, that the person in charge is the person who is the least intelligent, the least understanding of what's going on, and the person with the least power is the one who's most intelligent, and so on. So I decided that Constable Twitten would be this young... He's 22, he's come straight from sort of police college. Well, he's been to a few other police constabularies and always been dismissed almost immediately because he's just too clever and he annoys everybody by being so clever. So he's arrived, he's kind of immediately spotting what's going on, and he's not very popular with anybody because he's much too clever.
Well, he is Lord Peter Wimsey in uniform, really, isn't he? And you constantly refer to him as Clever Clogs Twitten, amateur sociologist and know-it-all. Mm-hmm. And this time he's using Nancy Mitford's book Noblesse Oblige to spot who the wrong'uns are, isn't he?
It was a nice coincidence. These books are set in 1957, and Noblesse Oblige came out in 1956, and it was the book that introduced the world, the idea of you and non-you speech, which was really controversial at the time, and I think people had a lot of fun with it as well, that, you know, the upper classes didn't say radio, they said wireless, didn't say mirror, they said looking glass, and so on. And the idea was that the social classes were beginning to... You know, the demarcations are becoming less obvious, except in their vocabulary. And so Twitten has read the book and thinks it's jolly interesting and is aware that all the people he works with say mirror and not looking glass. And then, of course, what happens is that part of the plot is a lord who is living in Brighton, and he seems to use non-new language. So this has to be explained. Is he a fraud? or has he been brought up by his father to not to obey these social demarcations of language? So anyway, that becomes part of the plot in quite a big way towards the end.
I mean, in some ways, it's also a bit of a throwback to Eat, Shoots and Leaves, the correct use of the English language. Do you find yourself unable to escape that part of your past?
I would like to escape it to a certain extent, I will not lie. But on the other hand, it was a book that brought me great blessings. It was an extraordinary lucky thing to happen that a book that was written without any expectations at all would be a massive bestseller. And even now, as I say that, I think maybe that didn't happen. Maybe that didn't happen because it was so weird that it should happen. You know, it sold 3 million copies. It did brilliantly in America. It was number one. When I went to promote it in America 6 months after it came out in the UK, it was already number one on Amazon before it was published. And people were clamouring. You know, it was like, it wasn't quite, when Dickens arrived and they... or in the States. But I was greeted as this sort of heroine of the English language, which was exciting, but at the same time, quite scary. I thought it was quite scary. I felt that great, syndrome? Fraud syndrome, whatever it is,
Imposter
syndrome. Yes, I really did think, oh, I really don't deserve this. And I also was a bit scared by, of course, people's strength of feeling, which meant that maybe they would take up arms or something, on this cause, which I didn't have as strong feelings about as they did. So I am very glad that it's passed. But I cannot, as I say, I can't lie. It bought me a house. It set me up very well for the rest of my life. And it's put me in a position where I can do what I'm doing now, which is to write a book a year in a series of something that I've invented, and without a great worry, without the worry that, I have to have a second job in order to finance that. At the moment, who knows what the future will bring.
Well, and use correct English. It is the man that got away rather than the man who got away. The book is absolutely stuffed full of shady characters, seaside goings on, and scams. And I believe that at least two of the scams that you feature, the gold brick scam and the unfinished house scam, were actual 1940s and 50s scams that were going on?
Well, the gold brick scam I'd read about in a marvellous... One of the reasons it's lovely writing about this period, actually, is the number of books that were written for the general public about the law and the police and so on. And there were many good writers doing it. And so I read a book called Scotland Yard by Sir Harold Scott, who was one of the commissioners of the Metropolitan Police, I think. He mentions the gold brick scam as something that there was a gold brick in the so-called Black Museum that they had at Scotland Yard. And he tells the story of how people would sell gold bricks when, in fact, of course, they were selling brass bricks with mercury inside them or something to make them heavy enough. So I do have the gold brick scam. And the unfinished house, I am a bit worried about this one because I encountered it in a wonderful series of films that were made in the 50s for theatrical release. They would be the B features, I think. And they were, again, it was called Scotland Yard. It was a series called Scotland Yard. And each one of those takes up a case that is supposedly in the files of Scotland Yard. And this one is about confidence tricksters who set up a dating agency, a bogus dating agency, and they would themselves woo, rich people and then draw them into this scam about an unfinished house that just needed a bit more money to finish it. And so gullible women particularly were drawn into this. They would go and see the house and they would never be seen again because they were murdered at the house and all their money disappeared. And there would be postcards sent from Oslo or somewhere to their relatives saying, I've decided to live abroad. So I thought that was a brilliant story and presumed it was true. But now I wonder if those cases in those Scotland Yard files were actually invented by scriptwriters, in which case I've used somebody else's idea.
They're probably not around anymore to come after you, are they?
Well, I just hope I haven't lived in it. But it was very compelling. I thought it was a very compelling story.
And there's plenty of period detail. I know you live in Brighton, and presumably you're quite interested in the local history of the area.
Yeah.
Actually, the rather sad goings on of the 1950s, where all that wonderful Regency architecture was being pulled down so that we could have the Brighton Conference Centre.
Yes, we all rejoice at that every day as we pass it. Oh, thank goodness they pulled down some Regency stuff in order to make this. Yes, no, it is quite a nice, it's a good period from that point of view. I have been reading the local papers from that period. I'm really focusing on this 1 year, 1957. Originally, I was thinking it could be wider, it could be sort of just nebulous kind of 1950s. Then I fixed on 1957. And then when I started writing the books, I realised that I didn't... what's often the case with a series is it, obviously you must move forward in time in some way. But if we went forward a year for each book, I'd have to research another year. I didn't want to do that. And I also didn't want to leave 1957. I liked it. So I decided to move each book forward by just a month. So the first book, Shot in the Dark, is set in June 1957, and so on. And I've just written the August one, which will come out next year, which is called Murder by Milk Bottle, which I think tells you rather too much about the plot. But that was a response to when I was reading the papers from that summer. There was so much milk promotion was going on. It was an enormous time for milk. There was a milk girl who visited places. There were dairy princess beauty contests. They had cows. Actually, they had a herd of cows on the pavilion lawns in Brighton as a stunt for promoting milk. There were milk bars opening all over the place. It was extraordinary. So I couldn't resist the milk theme for the third one.
It strikes me that 1957 actually was rather a hopeful year, that rationing was over. And, I mean, you make a couple of sly references to 1957 being the age of information, and you can find out anything from a library within a week, which rather tickled me. But it does strike me that it was Britain coming out of the post-war years.
I absolutely agree. I found something online once after I'd started writing the books that there'd been some poll of people asking them the best year of the 20th century, and a lot of people, the majority, you know, the largest number, had said 1957. And so that was just luck on my part. But I think it was, as you said, I'd thought about how optimistic it was. I think people wasted no time putting the war behind them. They tried to put the war behind them as quickly as possible, but it took a while. And as you say, rationing was now over, conscription was coming to an end. And I think it was this outburst of colour. There was more television to watch, films and so on. There was lots of experimentation in that area. And we got the rise of the teenager as well. But I think I come from a working class background, and I think for the working class, you know, this "you've never had it so good," which was said in 1957, I think there was a sense that a lot of people who remembered before the war couldn't believe that they could go to the seaside for a holiday, that they had working plumbing in their houses, you know, all that sort of thing was making them feel very optimistic.
And places like Brighton were the areas where the working class and the locals and the upper classes would all mix together, both to relax and also to graft, I suppose.
Yes. Yes. It's a very rich setting somehow, Brighton. I think maybe anywhere would be if you looked at it enough, but there are aspects of it. The fishermen, you know, I haven't even touched yet. For the man that got away, I've got a wax museum and a nightclub. I've never done the wax museum before, and I so enjoyed imagining this terrible, dusty old wax museum with terrible, terrible figures in it. You know, there are so many things like that that you have at the seaside.
Yes, places of curiosity. And your wax museum has a blind wax model maker.
Yes. Oh, he's pretending.
No spoilers.
It's very obvious from very early on that he is not what he seems.
And I believe that you yourself have contacts with the blind community of the Brighton area.
Oh, yes, yes. St Dunstan's, as it used to be called, are now Blind Veterans UK, is very close to where I live. I used to travel with one of my dogs once a week to Blind Veterans just as a taking him as a pat dog to be cuddled. We do it once a week. And then when I was looking to move out of Brighton to somewhere slightly quieter, I moved to Ovingdean, which is where BV UK is. And now I take my other dog. So we still go once a week. Oh, it's delightful. It's a very pleasant thing all round, I have to say. The dogs enjoy it. People enjoy it. We enjoy it. It's quite tiring. After an hour of that, my little dog, who is, you know, quite bouncy normally, is pretty tired when he gets home because he's been cuddled non-stop for an hour.
There's worse ways of spending your life, I suppose.
The only thing I have to keep saying to people, please don't give him anything to eat, because I know that it will excite him too much and then we'll have trouble. But people are very kind and always say, shall I give him a bit of my cake? Please don't.
So you get to see firsthand just how important it is that books and entertainment are made fully accessible for those of us who have lost our sight.
Yes, absolutely. And the programmes there are very, very good, it seems. People are very impressed by the way they're offered technology, have things explained to them that they didn't know, often didn't know was possible, really didn't know that there was this help available. I'm only a visitor. I'm just offering up my dog's body. Pimping the dog.
Actually, we must mention the audiobook. Matt Green is Twitten.
Oh, I'm so pleased you think so. I love him so much. When it was on the radio, he played Twitten. And it became more and more about Twitten, to be honest, on the radio. It was a four-hander. In every episode, each character had a story. It was very important to do that. And that's the same in the books, actually. Each one of them has a story in each book. But because he's the one that actually solves the crimes, it did seem that it would be natural that he should do them. And what happened in the series was that he took over narrating as well. And I think very highly of Matt. I think he's a very clever boy, and he's got a marvellous voice. And he's just a very intelligent reader. So I knew he would. And he's a comedian. So, you know, in every way, he was the right person to do it. I was thrilled to bits that he was able to do it.
He's got an amazing repertoire of voices. I mean, Mrs. Groynes' voice is just...
Oh, great!
Well, thank you so much for coming in and being a guest on Read On.
Oh, thank you very much. I've had a lovely time.
Anyway, the slogan worked. Whatever they wanted to know and wherever they wanted to go, holidaymakers did inquire of a Brighton belle. The whole scheme was a massive success. People asked the bells everything they could think of: the quickest way to the station, how many pebbles were on the beach, which horse to back in the 3:45 at Doncaster, where was the nearest place to spend a penny, how to tell the difference between heat rash and smallpox, and, most frequently, what time they got off work and did they favour a baby sham, the genuine champagne perry. It wasn't easy to become a Brighton bell. The prerequisites eliminated 99% of the female population at a stroke. You had to be tall, shapely, and fair of face, with excellent posture. Also, well-spoken, courteous, blind to class difference, and fluent in at least three foreign languages. You must be helpful and kind, and a total pro at brushing off sexual advances without causing offence. Basically, you had to be Grace Kelly, only without the recent romantic attachment to a member of the House of Grimaldi, because you also had to be single.
Matt Green narrating The Man That Got Away, written by my guest, Lynn Truss. Out now in print, ebook, and audio, wherever you buy your books. And a selection of other books written by Lynn, including Eat, Shoots and Leaves, is available from the RNIB Library. For more information, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. Now it's back to Mary Louise Fitzpatrick for the books of her life. Mary Louise, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Gosh, I grew up in a household of books and readers, so there were so many books. Probably that first kind of standout one was Little Women. Like for a lot of girls, I suppose, reading was that. It was a book that it started out seeming like a children's book. And then, of course, they grow in the book and become teenagers and then become young women. and go into marriage. So reading it as a child, that was a surprise. I wasn't expecting that to happen. And of course, I fell in love with Jo, like everybody does, and wanted to be like her. And of course, she's a writer. But I knew I was more like Amy, the youngest sister who's spoiled and a bit bratty and is a painter, is an artist. And about 6 years ago, I got to visit the Alcott House in Concord, Massachusetts, and also the Alcott Graves at Sleepy Hollow Cemetery. Really, I mean, Louisa May Alcott, she absolutely, it was an autobiographical book, which is probably why it speaks to people still, is because they are real girls and they've got flaws and they're human and they are dealing with, it's the Civil War is happening and they're dealing with poverty of a kind. It's kind of genteel poverty. But what I was delighted to discover was that May, who is the real Amy, she went on painting, unlike Amy in the book, who gives up the minute she marries. May actually lived in Paris and she exhibited in the Paris salons and her work was respected. She died young and Louise actually brought up her little girl. And so it's just really interesting to find out the rest of the story, but also amazing to walk in the rooms because it is literally like you've walked into the book.
On New Year's Eve, the parlour was deserted, for the two younger girls played dressing maids and the two elder were absorbed in the all-important business of getting ready for the party. Simple as the toilets were, there was a great deal of running up and down, laughing and talking, and at one time a strong smell of burnt hair pervaded the house. Meg wanted a few curls about her face, and Jo undertook to pinch the papered locks with a pair of hot tongs. "Ought they to smoke like that?" asked Beth, from her perch on the bed. "It's the dampness drying," replied Jo. "What a queer smell. It's like burnt feathers," observed Amy, smoothing her own pretty curls with a superior air. "There now, I'll take off the papers and you'll see a cloud of little ringlets," said Jo, putting down the tongs. She did take off the papers, but no cloud of ringlets appeared, for the hair came with the papers, and the horrified hairdresser laid a row of little scorched bundles on the bureau before her victim. "Oh, oh, oh, what have you done? I'm spoiled. I can't go. My hair, oh, my hair," wailed Meg, looking with despair at the uneven frizzle on her forehead.
Liza Ross, narrating Little Women by Louisa May Alcott, which is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I'm going all classic here, and I'm not actually a big reader of the classics, but Jane Austen, Pride and Prejudice, or Sense and Sensibility are my rereads. You know, I pick them up every couple of years and reread one or the other. And if I'm not in a good place in my life or I'm feeling down in any way, it'll be one of those. They're romantic and they're comforting. But I also find that I'm always struck by how the mind games that people are playing with themselves and each other in the stories are things that are human and we still do them today. You know, while the manner is maybe a couple of centuries old, the way people exploit other people's politeness, that still happens today. That thing of ignoring the elephant in the room because you couldn't possibly point it out. You couldn't possibly be that rude and it would upset everybody. You know, that's still there today. And she makes me laugh so much. She's so sharp in her observance of humanity.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. However little known the feelings or views of such a man may be on his first entering a neighbourhood, this truth is so well fixed in the minds of the surrounding families that he is considered as the rightful property of some one or other of their daughters. "My dear Mr. Bennet," said his lady to him one day, "have you heard that Netherfield Park is let at last?" Mr. Bennet replied that he had not. "But it is," returned she, "for Mrs. Long has just been here, and she told me all about it." Mr. Bennet made no answer.
"Do not you want to know who has taken it?" cried his wife impatiently. "You want to tell me, and I have no objection to hearing it." This was invitation enough.
Amelia Fox, narrating Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, which is available from the RNIB Library. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
I absolutely love Elizabeth Strout. She's a wonderful writer. And my favourite books of hers are Olive and Olive Again. I'm not a huge fan of short stories normally, but these are two books with this central character that the short stories circle around. And she's such a wonderful, complex, flawed main character. And we get to see her from all sorts of angles. Sometimes it's her story. Sometimes she's right in the background of another story. And I just found it fascinating to look at a character that way. And also, of course, the stories are set in one setting, one town. And there's a cast, and you keep catching glimpses of people from other stories, which I loved. But I really, really adored the character of Olive. She's just such a wonderful, curmudgeonly, forthright, honest character who's aware of her own flaws, and right into old age, she's examining herself all the time and trying to be more self-aware.
"How is she?" asks Olive, running water into the sink. Henry stares out at the bay, at the skinny spruce trees along the edge of the cove. And it seems beautiful to him, God's magnificence there in the quiet stateliness of the coastline and the slightly rocking water. "She's fine," he answers. Not at the moment, but soon, he will walk over to Olive and put his hand on her arm. Olive, who has lived through her own sorrows. For he understood long ago, after Jim O'Casey's car went off the road and Olive spent weeks going straight to bed after supper, sobbing harshly into a pillow. Henry understood then that Olive had loved Jim O'Casey, had possibly been loved by him, though Henry never asked her, and she never told. Just as he did not tell her of the gripping, sickening need he felt for Denise until the day she came to him to report Jerry's proposal and he said, "Go."
Stephanie Elaine, narrating Olive Kitteridge, written by Elizabeth Strout, which is available from the RNIB Library. Marie-Louise Fitzpatrick, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thanks. Lovely to be here.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Redsail, which is REDSZELL, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week. And don't forget to read on.